think of the now. No time to look back. No time to say how. This rhyme was repeated in almost every letter Sandy, Squeaky, Gypsy, or Brenda sent to the defendants. Its meaning was obvious. Don't tell them anything. Through a barrage of letters, telegrams, and attempted visits, the Manson girls tried to get Beausoleil, Atkins, and Kasabian to dump their present attorneys, repudiate any incriminating statements they may have made, and engage in a united defense. Though Beausoleil agreed that the whole thing balances on whether the family stays together in their heads and doesn't break up and start testifying against itself, he decided, "I'm going to keep my present lawyer." Bobby Beausoleil had always been somewhat independent. Less handsome than pretty, the girls had nicknamed him Cupid, Beausoleil had had bit parts in several movies, written music, formed a rock group, and had his own harem, all before meeting Manson. Leslie, Gypsy, and Kitty had all lived with Bobby before joining Charlie. Beausoleil requested that Squeaky and the others not visit him so often. They were taking up all his visiting time, when the person he really wanted to see was Kitty, who was expecting his child in less than a month. Beausoleil wasn't the only one being pressured. Without Susan Atkins, the prosecution had no case against Manson, and Manson knew it. Family members called Richard Caballero at all hours of the day and night. When cajoling didn't work, they tried threats. Less because of their pressure than that of his own client, Caballero finally gave in and let some of the Manson girls, though not Manson himself, visit Susan. It was, at best, a holding action. At any moment, Susan could insist on seeing Charlie, and Caballero would be unable to prevent it. After Susan's story had appeared in the Los Angeles Times, little signs had appeared on the walls at Sybil Brand reading, "Sadie Glutz is a snitch." This greatly upset Susan, and each time something like this happened, the scales seemed to tip a little more in Manson's favor. Manson was also aware that if Susan Atkins refused to testify at the trial, our only hope lay with Linda Kasabian. After a time, Linda's attorney, Gary Fleischman, refused to see Gypsy, so persistent had her visits become. If Linda didn't testify, Gypsy told him on numerous occasions, everyone would get off. Fleischman did take her along one time when he went to see his client. Gypsy told Linda, in the presence of several persons, that she should lie and say that on the nights of the Tate-LaBianca murders, she had never left Spawn Ranch, but remained with her at the waterfall. Gypsy promised to back up her story. Given a choice between Susan and Linda as the star witness for the prosecution, I much preferred Linda. She hadn't killed anyone. But in the rush to get the case to the grand jury, we'd made the deal with Susan, and like it or not, we were stuck with it. Unless Susan bolted. Yet this posed its own problems. If Susan didn't testify, we'd need Linda, but without Susan's testimony, we had no evidence against Linda, so what could we offer her? Fleischman wanted immunity for his client, yet from Linda's standpoint, it would be better to be tried and acquitted than get immunity, testify against Manson and the others, and risk retribution by the family. We were very worried at this point. Exactly how worried is evidenced by a telephone call I made. After Manson had been indicted for the Tate-LaBianca murders, the Inyo County authorities had dropped the arson charges against him, though they had a strong case. I called Frank Foles and asked him to refile the charges, which he did on February 6th. We were that afraid that Manson would be set free. February 1970. That an accused mass murderer could emerge a counterculture hero seemed inconceivable. But to some, Charles Manson had become a cause. Just before she went underground, Bernadine Dorn told the Students for a Democratic Society convention, offing those rich pigs with their own forks and knives, and then eating a meal in the same room, far out. The weathermen dig Charles Manson. the underground paper Tuesday's Child, which called itself the voice of the Yippies, blasted its competitor, the Los Angeles Free Press, for giving too much publicity to Manson, then spread his picture across the entire front page with a banner naming him Man of the Year. The cover of the next issue had Manson on a cross. Manson posters and sweatshirts appeared in psychedelic shops, along with Free Manson buttons. Gypsy and other spokesmen for the family took to the late-night radio talk shows to play Charlie's songs and denounce the prosecution for framing an innocent man. Stretching his pro-per privileges to their utmost limits, Manson himself granted a number of interviews to the underground press. He was also interviewed by phone from the county jail by several radio stations, and his visitors list now included among the material witnesses some familiar names. I fell in love with Charlie Manson the first time I saw his cherub face and sparkling eyes on TV, exclaimed Jerry Rubin. On a speaking tour during a recess in the Chicago 7 trial, Rubin visited Manson in jail, giving rise to the possibility that Manson might be considering the use of disruptive tactics during his own trial. According to Rubin, Charlie rapped for 3 hours, telling him, among other things, "Rubin, I am not of your world. I've spent all my life in prison. When I was a child, I was an orphan and too ugly to be adopted. Now, I am too beautiful to be set free." His words and courage inspired us, Rubin later wrote. Manson's soul is easy to touch because it lays quite bare on the surface. We Are Everywhere by Jerry Rubin, New York, Harper and Row, 1971. Yet Charles Manson, revolutionary martyr, was a difficult image to maintain. Rubin admitted being angered by Manson's incredible male chauvinism. A reporter for the Free Press was startled to find Manson both anti-Jewish and anti-black. And when one interviewer tried to suggest that Manson was as much a political prisoner as Huey Newton, Charlie, obviously perplexed, asked, "Who's he?" As yet, the pro-Mansonites appeared to be a small, though vocal, minority. If the press and TV reports were correct, a majority of the young people whom the media had lumped together under the label hippies disavowed Manson. Many stated that the things he espoused, such as violence, were directly contrary to their beliefs. And more than a few were bitter about the guilt by association. "It was almost impossible to hitchhike anymore," one youth told a New York Times reporter. "If you're young, have a beard, or even long hair, motorists look at you as if you're a kill-crazy cultist and jam the gas." The irony was that Manson never considered himself a hippie, equating their pacifism with weakness. If the family members had to have a label, he told his followers, he much preferred calling them slippies, a term which, in the context of their creepy-crawly missions, was not inappropriate. What was most frightening was that the family itself was growing. The group at Spawn had increased significantly. Each time Manson made a courtroom appearance, I spotted new faces among the known family members. It could be presumed that many of the new converts were sensation seekers, drawn like moths to the glare of publicity. What we didn't know, however, was how far they would go to gain attention or acceptance. Leslie Van Houten was legally sane, Judge Dell ruled on February 6th, basing his decision on the confidential reports of the three psychiatrists and granting her motion for a substitution of attorneys. In court the same day, Manson unexpectedly called our bluff. "Let's have an early trial setting. Let's go tomorrow or Monday. That's a good day for a trial." Keene set a trial date of March 30th, the date already assigned Susan Atkins. That gave us a little more time, but not nearly enough. On February 16th, Keene heard Manson's motion for a change of venue. "You know, there has been more publicity on this, even more than the guy who killed the President of the United States," Manson said. "You know, it is getting so far out of proportion that to me it is a joke, but actually the joke might cost me my life." Though the other defense attorneys would later submit similar motions, arguing that it would be impossible for their clients to obtain fair trials in Los Angeles because of the extensive pre-trial publicity, Manson didn't argue this too strongly. The motion was really trivial, he said, because it doesn't seem it could be done anywheres. Though Keene disagreed with Manson's contention that he couldn't obtain a fair trial, he did observe, in denying the motion, that a change of venue, even if warranted, would be ineffectual. This was also the view of the prosecution. It was doubtful if there was any place in California or the rest of the United States where the publicity had not reached. Each time the defense made a motion, and there would be hundreds before the end of the trial, the prosecution had to be prepared to answer. Though Aaron and I shared the verbal arguments, I prepared the written briefs, many of which required considerable legal research. All this was in addition to the heavy investigative responsibilities I had taken on. Yet the latter job had its special satisfactions. At the start of February, there were still huge holes in our case, big areas where we had almost no information whatsoever. For example, I still had very little insight into what made Charles Manson tick. By the end of the month, I had that, and a great deal more. For by then I understood, for the first time, Manson's motive, the reason why he'd ordered these murders. I rarely interview a witness just once. Often the fourth or fifth interview will bring out something previously forgotten or deemed insignificant, which in proper context may prove vital to my case. When I had questioned Greg Jacobson before the grand jury, my primary concern had been to establish the link between Manson and Melcher. Re-interviewing the talent scout, I was surprised to discover that since meeting Manson at Dennis Wilson's home in the early summer of 1968, Jacobson had had over 100 long talks with Charlie, mostly about Manson's philosophy. An intelligent young man, who flirted off and on with the hippie lifestyle, Greg had never joined the family, though he'd often visited Manson at Spawn Ranch. Besides seeing in Manson certain commercial possibilities, Jacobson had found him intellectually stimulating. He was so impressed that he often touted him to others, such as Rudy Altobelli, the owner of 10,050 Cielo Drive, who had been both Terry Melcher's and Sharon Tate's landlord. I was surprised at the wide variety of people Manson knew. Charlie was a chameleon, Greg said. He often professed that he had 1,000 faces and that he used them all. He told me that he had a mask for everyone. Including the jury? I wondered, realizing that if Manson put on the mask of the peace-loving hippie at the trial, I'd be able to use Greg's remark to unmask him. I asked Greg why Manson felt it necessary to don masks. Answer: so he could deal with everyone on their own level, from the ranch hand at Spawn to the girls on the Sunset Strip to me. I was curious as to whether Manson had a real face. Greg thought he had. Underneath it all, he had very firm beliefs. It was rare to find a man who believed in his convictions as strongly as Charlie did, who couldn't be swayed. What were the sources of Manson's beliefs? I asked. Charlie rarely, if ever, gave anyone else credit for his philosophy, Greg replied, but it was obvious that Charlie was not above borrowing. Had Manson ever mentioned Scientology or the Process? The Process, also known as the Church of the Final Judgment, was a very strange cult, led by one Robert de Grimston, true name Robert Moore, who, like Manson, was an ex-Scientologist. Its members worshipped both Satan and Christ. I'd only begun to look into the group, acting on the basis of a newspaper story which indicated Manson might have been influenced by them. However, Jacobson said Manson had never mentioned either Scientology or the Process. Greg himself had never heard of the latter group. Did Charlie ever quote anyone? I asked Greg. Yes, he replied. The Beatles and the Bible. Manson would quote verbatim whole lyrics from the Beatles' songs, finding in them a multitude of hidden meanings. As for the Bible, he most often quoted Revelation 9, but in both cases he usually used the quotations as support for his own views. Though I was very interested in this odd coupling and would later question Greg in depth about it, I wanted to know more about Manson's personal beliefs and attitudes. Question: What did Manson say, if anything, about right and wrong? Answer, he believed you could do no wrong, no bad. Everything was good. Whatever you do is what you are supposed to do. You were following your own karma. The philosophical mosaic began taking shape. The man I was seeking to convict had no moral boundaries. It was not that he was immoral, but totally amoral. And such a person is always dangerous. Question. Did he say it was wrong to kill a human being? Answer. He said it was not. Question. What was Manson's philosophy re-death? Answer. There was no death to Charlie's way of thinking. Death was only a change. The soul or spirit can't die. That's what we used to argue all the time, the objective and the subjective and the marriage of the two. He believed it was all in the head, all subjective. He said that death was a fear that was born in man's head and can be taken out of man's head, and then it would no longer exist. Death to Charlie, Greg added, was no more important than eating an ice cream cone. Yet once, in the desert, Jacobson had run over a tarantula, and Manson had angrily berated him for it. He had denounced others for killing rattlesnakes, picking flowers, even stepping on a blade of grass. To Manson, it was not wrong to kill a human being, but it was wrong to kill an animal or plant. Yet he also said that nothing was wrong. Everything that happened was right. That Manson's philosophy was riddled with such contradictions apparently bothered his followers little, if at all. Manson said that each person should be independent, but the whole family was dependent on him. He said that he couldn't tell anyone else what to do, that they should do what your love tells you, but he also told them, I am your love, and his wants became theirs. I asked Greg about Manson's attitude toward women. I was especially interested in this because of the female defendants. Women had only two purposes in life, Charlie would say, to serve men and to give birth to children. But he didn't permit the girls in the family to raise their own children. If they did, Charlie claimed, they would give them their own hang-ups. Charlie believed that if he could eliminate the bonds created by parents, schools, churches, society, he could develop a strong white race. Like Nietzsche, whom Manson claimed to have read, Charlie believed in a master race. According to Charlie, Greg continued, women were only as good as their men. They were only a reflection of their men all the way back to Daddy. A woman was an accumulation of all the men she had been close to. Then why were there so many women in the family? I asked. There were at least 5 girls to every man. It was only through the women, Greg said, that Charlie could attract the men. Men represented power, strength, but he needed the women to lure the men into the family. As with others I interviewed, I asked Greg for examples of Manson's domination. Greg gave me one of the best I'd yet found. He said he had had dinner with the family on 3 occasions. Each time Manson sat alone on the top of a large rock, the other members of the family sitting on the ground in a circle around him. Question. Did Tex Watson ever get up on the rock? Answer. No, of course not. Question. Did anyone else in the family get up there? Answer. Only Charlie. I needed many, many more examples like this, so that when I offered all of them at the trial, the jury would be led to the irresistible conclusion that Manson had such a hold over his followers, and specifically his co-defendants, that never in a million years would they have committed these murders without his guidance, directions, and orders. I asked Greg about Charlie's ambitions. Charlie wanted to be a successful recording artist, Greg said. Not so much as a means to making money as to get his word out to the public. He needed people to live with him, to make love, to liberate the white race. What was Manson's attitude toward blacks? Greg replied that Charlie believed there were different levels when it came to race, and the white man occupied a higher level than the black. This was why Charlie was so strongly opposed to black-white sex. You would be interfering with the path of evolution. You would be mixing up nervous systems, less evolved with more evolved. According to Jacobson, Charlie believed that the black man's sole purpose on Earth was to serve the white man. He was to serve the white man's needs. But Blackie had been on the bottom too long, Charlie said. It was now his turn to take over the reins of power. This was what Helter Skelter, the black-white revolution, was all about. Greg and I would talk about this on more than a half-dozen separate occasions. What before had been only fragments, bits, and pieces now began slipping into place. The picture that eventually emerged, however, was so incredibly bizarre as to be almost beyond belief. There is a special feeling you develop over years of interviewing people. When someone is lying or not telling everything he knows, you can often sense it. On re-interviewing Terry Melcher, I became convinced that he was withholding something. There wasn't time for pussyfooting. I told Terry I wanted to talk to him again, only this time he should have his attorney, Chet Lappin, present. When we met in Lappin's office on the 17th, I put it to him bluntly. You're not leveling with me, Terry. You're keeping something back. Whatever it is, eventually it will come out. It would be far better if you told me about it now, rather than have the defense surprise us with it on cross-examination. Terry wavered for a few minutes, then decided to tell me. The day after news of Manson's involvement in the Tate murders broke, Terry had received a telephone call from London. The caller was Rudy Altobelli, the owner of 10,050 Cielo Drive. Rudy had told him, in confidence, that one day in March 1969, while he was taking a shower in the guest house, Manson had knocked on the door. Manson claimed to be looking for Terry, who had moved out some months before, but Altobelli, who was a successful business manager for a number of theatrical stars, suspected that Manson had actually come looking for him, as Manson had worked the conversation around to his own music and songs. In a rather subtle fashion, Altobelli had made it clear that he wasn't interested, and Manson had left. The guest house. Terry, I said, why didn't you tell me this before? I wasn't sure it was relevant. Christ, Terry, this places Manson inside the gate of the Tate residence. As you well know, to reach the guest house, he'd have to first pass the main house. This means Manson was familiar with the layout of the house and grounds. I don't know what could be any more relevant. Where's Altobelli now? Cape Town, South Africa, Melcher reluctantly replied. Checking his address book, he gave me the number of the hotel where he was staying. I called Cape Town. Mr. Altobelli had just checked out of the hotel, leaving no forwarding address. However, Terry told me that Rudy was planning to return to Los Angeles for a few days sometime soon. The minute he hits L.A., I want to know it, I told him. As a safeguard, I put out a few feelers of my own, asking others who knew Altobelli to contact me if they saw or heard from him. The same day I talked to Melcher, half our extradition problems were solved. Patricia Katie Krenwinkel waived further proceedings and asked to be returned to California immediately. When she made her first courtroom appearance on the 24th, she requested Paul Fitzgerald of the Public Defender's Office as her attorney. Fitzgerald told the judge that, barring a possible conflict of interest, his office would be willing to represent her. Actually, there were two possible conflicts of interest. The Public Defender's Office was already representing Beausoleil on the Hinman murder, and Fitzgerald had earlier represented Manson, albeit briefly, before he went in pro per. A month later, Paul Fitzgerald resigned from the Public Defender's Office, after that office decided there was indeed a conflict of interest involved. Whether Fitzgerald's motive was purely idealistic, or he hoped to make a name for himself in private practice by winning an acquittal for his client, or both, the fact remained that he gave up a $25,000 a year salary and a promising career as a public defender to represent Patricia Krenwinkel, with virtually no pay. Terry Melcher didn't call. But another of my contacts did, reporting that Rudy Altobelli had returned to Los Angeles the previous day. I called Altobelli's attorney, Barry Hirsch, and arranged a meeting. Before leaving the office, I prepared a subpoena and stuck it in my pocket. Rather than ask Altobelli whether the guest house incident really occurred and risk a possible denial, I simply laid it out. Rudy, the reason I'm here is because I want to ask you about the time Manson came to the guest house. Terry told me about it. Fait accompli. Yes, Manson had been there, Rudy said. But did this mean he would have to testify? Rudy Altobelli was a bright, urbane, and, as I'd later discover, at times quite witty man. The roster of entertainment figures he'd represented included such stars as Katharine Hepburn, Henry Fonda, who for a time had rented the guest house at 10,050 Cielo Drive, Samantha Eggar, Buffy St. Marie, Christopher Jones, and Sally Kellerman, to name only a few. However, in common with almost all the other witnesses in this case, he was scared. On his return from Europe following the murders, he'd found that 10,050 Cielo Drive had been sealed by the police. Needing a place to stay, and unsure whether he might have been one of the intended victims, and still might be, he picked the safest place he could think of. He moved in with Terry Melcher and Candace Bergen, who were occupying a beach house in Malibu owned by Terry's mother, Doris Day. Though Terry and Rudy had spent many hours discussing the murders and possible suspects, Manson's name was never mentioned, Rudy said. When the news broke that Manson had been accused of the murders, a possible motive being his grudge against Melcher, Altobelli decided that he had probably chosen the least safe place in Southern California. He still shivered when recalling it. He had another reason for fear. In a sense, he, too, had rejected Manson. "Tell me about it, Rudy," I suggested. "Then we'll discuss whether you have to testify or not. But first, how do you know it was Manson?" "Because he'd met Manson once before," Altobelli said, "during the summer of 1968 at Dennis Wilson's house. Manson was living there at the time, and Rudy had dropped in while Dennis was playing a tape of Manson's music. He'd listened politely, commented that it was nice, the minimal courtesy possible, then left. At various times, Dennis and Greg had tried to interest him in Manson and his philosophy. Having worked hard for what money he had, Altobelli said, he was not sympathetic to Manson's sponging, and had told them exactly that. The incident had occurred about 8 or 9 on the evening of Sunday, March 23, 1969. Rudy remembered the date because he and Sharon had flown to Rome together the next day, Rudy on business, Sharon to rejoin her husband and to make a movie there. Rudy was alone in the guest house taking a shower when Christopher started barking. Grabbing a robe, he went to the door and saw Manson on the porch. While it was possible that Manson had knocked and the shower had muffled the sound, Rudy was irritated that he had opened the outside door and walked onto the porch uninvited. Manson started to introduce himself, but Rudy, somewhat brusquely, without opening the screen door that separated the porch from the living room, said, "I know who you are, Charlie. What do you want?" Manson said he was looking for Terry Melcher. Altobelli said Terry had moved to Malibu. When Manson asked for his address, Altobelli said he didn't know it, which was not true. Prolonging the conversation, Manson asked him what business he was in. Though Altobelli felt sure Manson already knew the answer, he replied, "The entertainment business." He added, "I'd like to talk to you longer, Charlie, but I'm leaving the country tomorrow and have to pack." Manson said he would like to talk to him when he returned. Rudy told him that he wouldn't be back for over a year. Another untruth, but he had no desire to talk further with Manson. Before Manson left, Rudy asked him why he had come back to the guest house. Manson replied that the people at the main house had sent him back. Altobelli said that he didn't like to have his tenants disturbed, and he would appreciate it if he wouldn't do so in the future. With that, Manson left. Though one question was uppermost in my mind, before asking it, I had Altobelli describe Manson, the lighting on the porch, exactly where each was standing. Since he had met Manson on a prior occasion, there was no question that this was a positive identification, but I wanted to be absolutely sure. Then I asked it, and held my breath until he answered. Rudy, who was up front that night? Sharon, Gibby, Wojtek, and Jay. 4 of the 5 Tate victims. This meant that Manson could have seen any or all of them. Prior to my talking to Rudy, we had assumed that Manson had never seen the people he had ordered killed. Rudy, all those people are dead. Was there anyone else up front who could testify to this? Rudy thought a moment. He had been up at the main house earlier in the evening, actually returning to the guest house only a few minutes before Manson arrived. I'm not sure, he said, but I'm almost positive Hatami was there. Sharok Hatami, a native of Iran, was Sharon's personal photographer and a good friend of both Polanski's. Hatami had been at the house that afternoon, Rudy knew, photographing Sharon while she was packing for her trip. I don't want to testify, Mr. Bugliosi, Rudy suddenly said. I can understand that. If there is any way I can avoid it, I won't call you to the stand. But realistically, considering the importance of what you've told me, the odds are that I will have to call you. We discussed the subject at some length before I gave him the subpoena. I then asked him, "Tell me about Sharon." In the short time he had known her, Rudy said, he had grown very fond of her. She was a beautiful person. Of course, she was physically beautiful, but by this he meant something else. She had a kind of warmth, a niceness which you sensed immediately on meeting her, but which, thus far in her career, no director had ever managed to bring out on the screen. They'd had many long talks. She'd called 10,050 Cielo Drive her love house. Rudy then told me something he said he had never told anyone else. I knew there was no way I could use it in the trial. It was hearsay, and though there are many exceptions to the hearsay rule, this couldn't come in under any of them. On the flight to Rome, Sharon had asked him, "Did that creepy-looking guy come back there yesterday?" So Sharon had seen Manson, the creepy-looking little guy who 4.5 months later would mastermind her murder. Something must have happened to have caused such a strong reaction, a confrontation of some sort. Could it be that Wojtek, who had an unpredictable temper, had got into an argument with Manson? Or that Manson had said something offensive to Sharon, and Jay had come to her defense? I called LAPD and told them to find Sharok Hatami. Lieutenant Helder contacted a friend of Colonel Tate's, who in turn located Hatami. I interviewed him in my office. Very emotionally, the Iranian photographer told me how much he had loved Sharon. Not romantic, but, he apologized for his broken English, one human being loving qualities other human being has. I told him I doubted if it could be better expressed. Yes, he'd once sent someone to the back house, one time. He didn't know the date, but it was the day before Sharon left for Europe. It was in the afternoon. He'd looked out the window and noticed a man walking into the yard, hesitant, as if he didn't know where he was going, yet cocky, as if he thought he owned the place. His manner irritated Hatami, and he went out on the porch and asked him what he wanted. I asked Hatami to describe the man. He said he was short, like Roman Polanski. Polanski was 5'5", Manson 5'2". Late 20s, thin, with long hair. What color hair? Dark brown. He didn't have a beard, but looked as if he needed a shave. How could he tell that? He'd walked off the porch onto the stone walk to confront him. They were at most 3 or 4 feet apart. With the exception of the age, Manson was 34, but could easily have been mistaken for younger. The description fitted. The man said he was looking for someone, mentioning a name Hatami did not recognize. Could it have been Melcher? I asked. Possible, Hatami said, but he really couldn't remember. It had meant nothing to him at the time. "This is the Polanski residence," Hatami told him. "This is not the place. Maybe the people you want is back there," pointing. "Take the back alley." By back alley, Hatami meant the dirt pathway in front of the residence which led to the guest house. But as I'd later argue to the jury, to an American, back alley meant a place where there were garbage cans, refuse. Manson must have felt he was being treated like an alley cat. I asked Hatami, "What tone of voice did you use?" He illustrated, speaking loudly and angrily. Roman was away, Hatami said, and he felt protective of Sharon. I wasn't happy that he was coming on the property and looking at people he doesn't know. How did the man react? He appeared upset, Hatami said. He turned and walked away without saying excuse me or anything. Just before this, however, Sharon came to the door and said, "Who is it, Hatami?" Hatami told her that a man was looking for someone. Showing Hatami a diagram of the house and grounds, I had him point to the spots where each was standing. Sharon was on the porch, the man on the walk, not more than 6 to 8 feet away, with no obstruction between them. There could be no question that Charles Manson saw Sharon Tate, and she him. Sharon had undoubtedly looked right into the eyes of the man who would order her death. We now had, for the first time, evidence that prior to the murders, Manson had seen one of his victims. Hatami had remained on the walk, Sharon on the porch, while the man went down the path toward the guest house. According to Hatami, he came back up the path in a minute or two, no more, and left the premises without saying anything. It was not as abrasive an incident as I was looking for, but together with Melcher's rejection and Altabelli's subtle put-down, Hatami's "take the back alley" was more than sufficient cause for Manson to have strong feelings against 10,050 Cielo Drive. Two, not only were these people obviously establishment, they were establishment in the very fields, entertainment, recording, motion pictures, in which Manson had tried to make it and failed. There was one discrepancy, the time. Hatami was positive the incident had occurred during the afternoon. Altabelli, however, was equally insistent that it was between 8 and 9 in the evening when Manson appeared on the guest house porch. While it was possible one or the other was confused, the most logical explanation was that Manson had gone to the guest house that afternoon, found no one there. Altabelli was out most of the afternoon making arrangements for his trip, then returned that evening. This was supported by Hatami's statement that Manson had come back up the path after a minute or two, no more, which hardly left time for his conversation with Altabelli. I had Hatami look at photographs of a dozen or so men. He picked out one, saying it looked like the man, though he couldn't be absolutely sure. It was a photograph of Charles Manson. In interviewing Hatami, I hadn't mentioned Manson's name. Not until the interview was almost over did Hatami realize that the man he had spoken to that day might have been the man accused of plotting Sharon's murder. Melcher to Altabelli to Hatami. If I hadn't suspected that Melcher was withholding something, it was possible that we might never have placed Manson inside the gate of 10,050 Cielo Drive. A similar chain, which had begun with my discovery of a short notation in the Inyo County files, led me to the missing piece in the motive for both the Tate and LaBianca murders. Finally, nearly 3 months after first requesting it, I obtained the tape Inyo County Deputy Sheriff Don Ward had made with the two miners, Paul Crockett and Brooks Poston. Ward had interviewed the pair on October 3, 1969, at Independence. This was a week before the Barker raid, and nearly a month and a half before LAPD learned of the Manson family's possible involvement in the Tate-LaBianca murders. Ward's interview had nothing to do with those murders, only the activities of the hippie types who were now living in Golar Wash. Crockett, a weather-worn miner in his mid-40s, had been prospecting in the Death Valley area in the spring of 1969 when he came across Manson's advance party at Barker Ranch. At this time it consisted of only two persons, a young runaway named Juanita Wildebush and Brooks Poston, a slender, rather docile 18-year-old who had been with the family since June 1968. Nights, Crockett would visit the pair, and the talk would invariably turn to one subject, Charlie. "And I couldn't believe what they were saying," Crockett observed. "I mean, it was so utterly ridiculous." It became obvious to Crockett that these people believed this Charlie to be the second coming of Christ. It was just as obvious that they feared him. And so Crockett, who was no stranger to mysticism, did something perhaps a little odd, but at least psychologically effective. He told them that, just like Charlie, he too had powers. "And I planted them with the idea that I had the power to keep Charlie from coming back up there." Other family members, including Paul Watkins, Tex Watson, Brenda McCann, and Bruce Davis, would occasionally show up at Barker with messages and supplies, and it didn't take long for the word to get back to Manson. Initially, he scoffed at the idea, but each time he tried to go to Barker, something happened. The truck broke down, Spawn Ranch was raided, and so on. Meanwhile, Juanita eloped with Bob Berry, Crockett's partner, and Crockett succeeded in unconverting several of Manson's most important male followers. Poston, Paul Watkins, who often acted as Manson's second-in-command, and somewhat later, Juan Flynn, a tall, strapping Panamanian cowboy who had worked at Spawn. When Crockett first met young Poston, he was a zombie. The phrase was Poston's own. He said that he had wanted to leave the family many times, but Manson had a vice grip on my mind, and I couldn't break the grip. I didn't know how to leave. Crockett discovered that Manson had programmed all his people to the extent that they're just like him. He has put all kinds of things in their heads. I didn't believe it could be done, but he has done it, and I've seen it working. Crockett began deprogramming Poston. He put him to work in his various mining ventures, built up his body, got him to thinking of other things than Manson. When Manson finally reached Barker in September 1969, Crockett, meeting him for the first time, found him a very clever man. He borders on genius. Then Manson told him some of the weirdest stories. "I thought it was all make-believe to start with." Before long, Crockett was not only convinced that Manson was insane, he was sure he would think no more of killing one of us than he would of stepping on a flower. In fact, he'd rather do that than step on a flower. Deciding that his own life expectancy was directly proportionate to his usefulness to Manson, Crockett made himself very useful, volunteering his truck to haul in supplies and so forth. He and the former Mansonites, now living with him in a small cabin near Barker, also began taking precautions. Among the weird tales Manson had told Crockett, that the black man was getting ready to blow the whole thing open. "Charlie has set up the whole thing. It's kind of like a storybook. He says Helter Skelter is coming down." "Helter Skelter is what he calls the Negro Revolt," Poston explained. "He says the Negroes are going to revolt and kill all the white men except the ones that are hiding in the desert." Long before this, Manson had told Poston, "When Helter Skelter comes down, the cities are going to be mass hysteria, and the cops, the piggies, he calls them, won't know what to do, and the beast will fall, and the black man will take over, that the Battle of Armageddon will be at hand." Poston told Deputy Ward, "One of Charlie's basic creeds is that all that girls are for is to fuck, and that's all they're for. And there is no crime, there is no sin, everything is all right, that it's all just a game, like the game of a little kid, only it's a grown-up game, and that God's getting ready to pull down the curtain on this game and start it over again with his chosen people." His chosen people were the family, Charlie said. He would lead them to the desert, where they would multiply until they numbered 144,000. He got this, Poston said, from reading things into the Bible, from Revelations. Manson apparently got the 144,000 figure from Revelation 7, which mentions the 12 tribes of Israel, each numbering 12,000. Also in Revelation, as well as in Hopi Indian legends, there was mention of a bottomless pit, Poston said. The entrance to this pit, according to Charlie, was a cave that he says is underneath Death Valley that leads down to a sea of gold that the Indians know about. Charlie claimed that every tuned-in tribe of people that's ever lived have escaped the destruction of their race by going underground, literally, and they're all living in a golden city where there's a river that runs through it of milk and honey, and a tree that bears 12 kinds of fruit, a different fruit each month or something like that, and you don't need to bring candles nor any flashlights down there. He says it will be all lit up because the walls will glow, and it won't be cold and it won't be too hot. There will be warm springs and fresh water, and people are already down there waiting for him. Both Atkins and Jacobson had already told me about Charlie's bottomless pit. The family loved to hear Charlie sermonize about this hidden land of milk and honey. They not only believed, they were so convinced that such a place existed that they spent days searching for the hole in the ground, which would lead them to the underground paradise. There was also a kind of desperation in the search, because it was here, underground in the bottomless pit, that they intended to hide and wait out Helter Skelter. It was obvious to both Crockett and Poston that Manson believed Helter Skelter was imminent. And there were the preparations. Manson had arrived at Barker Ranch in September 1969 with about 8 others, all heavily armed. More family members arrived the following week, driving stolen dune buggies and other vehicles. They began setting up lookout posts and fortifications, hiding caches of guns, gasoline, and supplies. It did not occur to Crockett and Poston, since neither was aware of the family's involvement in the Tate-LaBianca murders, that Manson might be fearful of something other than blacks. Manson hadn't given up on Poston, but Crockett's deprogramming had been very effective. Manson was even more upset about Paul Watkins leaving him, since Watkins, a good-looking youth with a way with women, had been Manson's chief procurer of young girls. Crockett, Poston, and Watkins had begun sleeping with their shotguns within reach. On at least 3 occasions, Charlie, Clem, and or the girls tried to creepy-crawl the cabin. Each time the trio had been lucky and had heard something, aborting the plan. Then one night Juan Flynn arrived to shoot some bull and admitted Manson had suggested he kill Crockett. Crockett persuaded Juan, who was far too independent to ever join the family, that he should leave the area. Crockett, accustomed to living as free and unencumbered as a mountain goat, was a mite stubborn. He felt he had as much right to be in Death Valley as Manson did. But he was also a realist. With Flynn gone and Watkins in town getting supplies, he and Poston were vastly outnumbered. Figuring my usefulness to Charlie had already vanished and that he would, if he considered it necessary, liquidate me immediately, if not sooner, Crockett had Poston fill the canteens and pack some grub. Under cover of night, they fled the area on foot, walking over 20 rugged miles to Warm Springs, then catching a ride to Independence, where they told Deputy Sheriff Ward about Charles Manson and his family. After hearing the tape, I arranged through Frank Falls for Crockett and Poston to come to Los Angeles. Though it was Crockett who had broken Manson's hold over Poston, the latter was by far the most articulate. Incidents, dates, places, snap, snap, snap. Crockett, by contrast, was evasive. I can feel their vibrations. I can't talk freely to you because they might know what I am saying. Crockett doubted if we could ever convict Manson, because he does nothing himself. His people do it all for him. He doesn't do anything anybody could pin on him. He added that all the women have been programmed to do exactly as he says, and they all have knives. He's got those girls so programmed that they don't even exist. They are a copy of him. Though I was interested in Crockett's contacts with Manson and the family, I was hopeful that he could give me something more important. Crockett had helped Poston, Watkins, and Flynn break away from Manson. To do this, he must have gained some insight into how Manson had gained control over them in the first place. Others had also said that Manson programmed his followers. Did he understand how he accomplished this? Crockett said he did, but when he tried to articulate it, he became bogged down in a morass of words and definitions, finally saying, "I can't explain it. It's all part of the occult." I decided I wouldn't be able to use Crockett as a witness. It was otherwise with Brooks Poston. The tall, gangly youth with the air of the hayseed about him was a fund of information about Manson and the family. A highly impressionable 17-year-old, Brooks Poston had met Manson at Dennis Wilson's house, and from that moment until he finally broke with Manson more than a year later to follow Crockett, I believed Charlie was J.C. Question. J.C.? Answer. Yeah, that's how Charlie always used to refer to Jesus Christ. Question. Did Manson ever tell you that he was J.C. or Jesus Christ? It wasn't so much stated as implied, Brooks said. Charlie claimed that he had lived before, nearly 2,000 years ago, and that he had once died on the cross. Manson had also told Greg Jacobson that he had already died once, and that death is beautiful. Charlie had a favorite story which he was fond of telling the family, complete with dramatic gestures and moans of pain. Brooks had heard it often. According to Charlie, while he was living in Haight-Ashbury, he had taken a magic mushroom, psilocybin trip. He was lying on a bed, but it became a cross, and he could feel the nails in his feet and hands and the sword in his side, and when he looked down at the foot of the cross, he saw Mary Magdalene, Mary Brunner, and she was crying, and he said, "I'm all right, Mary." He had been fighting it, but now he gave up, surrendered himself to death, and when he did, he could suddenly see through the eyes of everyone at the same time, and at that moment, he became the whole world. With such clues, his followers had little trouble guessing his true identity. I was curious about something. Up until his arrest in Mendocino County on July 28, 1967, Manson was charged with interfering with the questioning of a suspected runaway juvenile, Ruth Ann Morehouse. He was given 30 days, suspended, and placed on 3 years probation. Asked his occupation when booked, he said he was a minister. Charlie had always used his real name, Charles Mills Manson. On that occasion, however, and thereafter, he called himself Charles Willis Manson. Had Manson ever said anything about his name? I asked. Crockett and Poston both told me that they had heard Manson say, very slowly, that his name was Charles, Will is man's son, meaning that his will was that of the Son of Man. Although Susan Atkins had emphasized Charlie's surname in talking to Virginia Graham, I hadn't really thought until now how powerful that name was. Man, son. It was tailor-made for the infinite being role he was now seeking to portray. But Charlie carried all this yet a step further, Poston said. Manson claimed that the members of the family were the original Christians reincarnated, and that the Romans had returned as the establishment. It was now time, Manson told his closest followers, for the Romans to have their turn on the cross. Exactly how did Manson program someone? I asked Brooks. He had various techniques, Poston said. With a girl, it would usually start with sex. Charlie might convince a plain girl that she was beautiful, or if she had a father fixation, have her imagine that he was her father. He'd used both techniques with Susan Atkins. Or if he felt she was looking for a leader, he might imply that he was Christ. Manson had a talent for sensing and capitalizing on a person's hang-ups and or desires. When a man first joined the group, Charlie would usually take him on an LSD trip, ostensibly to open his mind. Then, while he was in a highly suggestible state, he would talk about love, how you had to surrender yourself to it, how only by ceasing to exist as an individual ego could you become one with all things. As with Jacobson, I queried Poston as to the sources of Manson's philosophy: Scientology, the Bible, and the Beatles. These three were the only ones he knew. A peculiar triumvirate. Yet by now I was beginning to suspect the existence of at least a fourth influence. The old magazines I'd found at Barker, Greg's mentioned that Charlie claimed to have read Nietzsche and that he believed in a master race, plus the emergence of a startling number of disturbing parallels between Manson and the leader of the Third Reich, led me to ask Poston, did Manson ever say anything about Hitler? Poston's reply was short and incredibly chilling. Answer: he said that Hitler was a tuned-in guy who had leveled the karma of the Jews. I spent most of 2 days interviewing Crockett and Poston, obtaining much new information, some of it very incriminating. For example, Manson had once suggested Poston take a knife, go into Shoshone, and kill the sheriff. In the first real test of his newly found independence, Poston had refused to even consider the idea. Before Crockett and Poston returned to Shoshone, I told them I wanted to talk to Juan Flynn and Paul Watkins. They weren't sure if Juan would talk to me. That big Panamanian cowboy was an independent cuss, but they thought Paul might. Since he was no longer procuring girls for Charlie, he had some free time on his hands. Watkins agreed to the interview, and I arranged for Watkins, Poston, and Crockett to stay in a motel in downtown L.A. "Paul, I need a new love." Paul Watkins was describing for me how Manson would send him out to recruit young girls. Watkins admitted that he liked his special role in the family. The only problem was, after he'd located a likely candidate, Charlie would insist on sleeping with her first. "Why didn't Manson pick up the girls himself?" I asked. "He was too old for most of the girls," the 19-year-old Watkins replied. "He frightened them. Also, I had a good line." It was also obvious that Watkins was better looking than Charlie. I asked Paul where he found the girls. "He might go down to the Sunset Strip where the teeny boppers hung out, or drive the highways watching for girls who were hitchhiking." Once Charlie, through the connivance of an older woman who posed as Watkins' mother, even had him arrange a phony registration at a Los Angeles high school so he could be closer to the action. Watkins also described the orgies that took place at the Gresham Street house and at Spawn. For a while there was one about every week. They would always start with drugs: grass, peyote, LSD, whatever was available, Manson rationing them out, deciding how much each person needed. "Everything was done at Charlie's direction," Paul said. "Charlie might dance around, everyone else following, like a train. As he'd take off his clothes, all the rest would take off their clothes. Then, when everyone was naked, they'd lie on the floor, and they'd play the game of taking 12 deep breaths and releasing them, and close eyes and then rub against each other, until eventually all were touching. Charlie would direct the orgy, arranging bodies, combinations, positions. He'd set it all up in a beautiful way, like he was creating a masterpiece in sculpture," Watkins said. "But instead of clay, he was using warm bodies." Paul said that the usual objective during the orgies was for all the family members to achieve a simultaneous orgasm, but they were never successful. Manson often staged these events to impress outsiders. If there were guests who he felt could be of some use to him, he'd say to the family, "Let's get together and show these people how to make love." Whatever the reaction, the impression was a lasting one. "It was like the devil buying your soul," Watkins said. Manson also used these occasions to eradicate hang-ups. If a person indicated reluctance to engage in a certain act, Manson would force that person to commit it. Male, female, 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 male, male, intercourse, cunnilingus, fellatio, sodomy. There could be no inhibitions of any kind. One 13-year-old girl's initiation into the family consisted of her being sodomized by Manson while the others watched. Manson also went down on a young boy to show the others he had rid himself of all inhibitions. Charlie used sex, Paul said. For example, when it became obvious that DeCarlo was making no effort to persuade his motorcycle gang to join the family, Manson told the girls to withhold their favors from